This is The Guardian.
Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu. Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The knockouts of the Champions League begin, and how? Well, not that brilliantly, if we're totally honest. Another pretty flat Spurs performance in Milan, creating not a lot and probably lucky to get away with a 1-0 defeat. Meanwhile, PSG without Kylian Mbappe are not as good as PSG with Kylian Mbappe. Bayern control most of the game, but end up holding on to a 1-0 victory to take back to Munich. Also today, we'll look back on a pretty straightforward Liverpool win in the Merseyside derby and a reflect on the damning verdict against UEFA following the Champions League final. There's an interesting report on referee abuse at grassroots level, and we'll ask the Arsenal fans on the panel if we were right to find the weekend's VAR as funny as we did last time out. We celebrate another male player coming out as gay, we find out if Jesse Marsh has updated his LinkedIn, welcome Neil Warnock back to the dugout, and talk about banning haddocks. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Philippe Auclair, bonjour, ça va?
Ça va bien, Max, et toi?
Ça va bien. Barry Glendenning, hello.
Bonjour.
And hello, Nicky Bandini.
Buongiorno.
Buongiorno. We should say, Nicky, you're in Phoenix. You watch the Super Bowl. It is 1 a.m. So
all,
to anyone who complains about recording at 8 a.m, you're a modern day hero.
I just thought, Max, I think you were probably up at 3 a.m. in Australia to do Stan Sport together. So I suppose I had to return the favour by being up at 1 a.m. for the podcast.
It's very kind of you. Let's start with the Spurs defeat at the San Siro against AC Milan. Look, Milan won, Nicky. Given their second half chances, do you think they're sort of waking up thinking, God, we could have actually put this to bed this time?
Well, it's funny you say that, Max, because I was thinking afterwards, you know, the last time Milan beat a club from North London in the Champions League, which is about 10 years ago, it was Arsenal. And they won that first leg. It was 4-0, wasn't it? And then they nearly blew it even after winning 4-0 in the first leg. So, yeah, they might think to themselves, actually, needed a better buffer than that. But I don't know. I think you really have to sort of frame it from the perspective of what Milan started the year as. Like we talked about this on Stan, Max. I mean, they went 7 games without a win. And during those 7 games without a win, they had a 3-game stretch, which was lose 3-0 to Inter in the Supercoppa, come back to Serie A, lose 4-0 to Lazio, and then after that lose 5-2 to Sassuolo. So they were very much in crisis. This is not the team that won the league last season. I mean, in many parts it is, but it's definitely a much less impressive side, or has been recently, than that. And they've really sort of gone into this period of consolidation of like, okay, right, no more having fun, no more of this sort of optimistic way of playing that purely got so much success out of last season. We're going to change the formation. We're going to go to a back three. We're going to make it all about just not conceding a goal first and foremost. So actually, I thought they kind of had the perfect game, getting that get that goal so early and being able to then sit in that low block, play for the counters, play for those wide balls. And yeah, it's true. In the second half, they had 2 really, really good chances to score a second goal, which, you know, unfortunately fell to Malik Thiaw, who's a defender and had a great game, I thought, by the way. So if he didn't score that chance, fair enough. And Charles Akétélé, who I don't think I've seen a footballer with less confidence than Charles Akétélé seems to have right now. So him not being able to hit the target from 3 yards out was no big surprise. So some missed opportunity there for certain. But I think, again, this is a team that 2 weeks ago was being absolutely pilloried for one of the most, having finally not lost by 5 goals. They still lost the derby to Inter 1-0 in the league, and it was such a miserable performance, such a desperate, abject performance. If you told me then that they could win this game at all, I would have not believed you.
Chris says, is there a way that Barry can put Daniel Levy in touch with Beaver, the goalie? I don't know that Fraser Forster will make it to Hugo's return. A bit harsh. I mean, he's let in 5 goals since he's been stuck in net since Hugo Lloris's injury, Barry. But I don't think any of them have been his fault. And I thought he made an amazing save in the build-up to this goal.
I'm staggered that anyone's criticising Fraser Forster. For anyone who hasn't seen it, it was a long ball down the left, sort of inside left channel. Theo Hernandez out-muscled Christian Romero, who should have done better to sort of knock it inside with his head. He shot from a narrow angle. Fraser Forster got down, saved with his chest. Then Bram Diaz, tried to rifle it home from 10 yards. And Forster, who was lying on the ground, somehow elevated himself enough to get an arm up and fingertip it. It was a sensational effort at a save. The ball looped up towards the crossbar and Bram Diaz had followed it up on his own shot and he just had the quite simple task of nodding it in from a couple of inches out. Certainly wasn't Fraser Forster's fault. I would be blaming Christian Romero and I think Eric Dyer was slightly culpable as well for not getting over quick enough to prevent Hernandez crossing the ball. So, yeah, it seems very harsh. I don't think Fraser Forster has done a thing wrong deputising for Lloris. And Lloris hasn't been playing particularly well this season either. So, no, I'm not having that. I thought Spurs were lucky enough to get away with a 1-0. They played quite well, but created very little. And they had a lot of set pieces, free kicks out wide and corners, but couldn't do much with them. Malik Chow had Kulusevski on a very tight rein. Son did very little. And I don't understand why Richarlison isn't playing more. I don't know if he's injured or not fully fit, but he's been festering on the bench and it seems really odd that he's not getting more starts.
Yeah, Jody says, the game hasn't been played yet, but why were Tottenham so awful against Milan and will it get any better under Conte? It is hard. I mean, I suppose, Nicky, to be fair, I'm not excluding Philippe, but he was focusing on the PSG Bayern game. Pape Matar-Sarr actually looked really quite good, I thought, Nicky. And I suppose if Spurs fans wanted any sort of crumbs of encouragement, him and Skip in central midfield was impressive, even though Spurs didn't create anything. But their midfield don't really create anything.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, it was all the players who weren't supposed to impress us who did impress us. I agree with Baz. I thought Forster's sort of second stop in that what ended up being the goal was one of the best saves I've ever seen that didn't matter. It was one of the best saves I've ever seen that is completely meaningless because he arrives and heads it home anyway, but it was still an incredible save. And I thought Assar was really, really solid in this game. He was in control of that midfield for a lot of it and doing the things that at times Milan's central midfield couldn't, frankly. I think there's sort of two sides to that, and this, it's not a criticism of him because I think he might have been Tottenham's best player, honestly. I think if I was to pick a man of the match Tottenham, it probably would be Sarr. But I think you can say that and say he had a very tidy game and say that it's still true that looking at that midfield, the one player who they were screaming for was the one who, of course, is injured, which is Bentancur, because Bentancur is the player who can turn and can make those transitions and actually make it something more than just a defensive screen. So they were missing something in that midfield, even though the two players who came in did pretty well. But it's a good point that Baz raises. Why isn't Richarlison starting more when he was on the pitch, when he came on? It was him who had that bit of muscle, that little bit of strength and positioning to get the was it chest down or head down? I can't remember anymore, but certainly to get him, he was the one who won the ball, held it up and laid it off for Sarr to get a shot from the edge of the box, which wasn't much of a chance, frankly, but it was as close as Tottenham came to having a chance in the whole game. I'm not sure I can agree with Baz that they played well. I thought they were crap. I'm sorry.
I didn't say well. I said well enough.
I mean, I think actually what we can really say is these are not, Philippe, two of the 16 best teams in Europe.
I think this is the first thing, perhaps one of the only things I was going to say, because I was really, really struggling with my feet for this game. And apparently I didn't miss much. It was freezing every 15 seconds and then carrying on. But you didn't have the feeling, really, from what I saw, that the little that I saw, that you had two contenders for actually even going deep in the competition, we're not even reaching the final or winning it, if anything. On Richarlison, the question I would put to you is that, who would make way for Richarlison if Son. Conte? Son, okay, Son makes way.
But I think Richarlison plays down the middle, right? That's where he's at his best, where he plays for Brazil. And, you don't swap him for Kane. But I agree, he adds an energy that they don't have. And Son is just out so wildly out of form that...
Well, here's a radical idea that Antonio Conte is not fond of, but he could change his formation.
No
yes.
way.
He could try something different, but it's not really his style, no. is it?
I also wanted to point out, does anyone else think that Christian Romero is unnecessarily violent? I mean, everyone sort of loves him because he's sort of got this swagger, but I mean, he almost broke Tonali's ankles twice yesterday. And like, he got sent off in the previous game. He goes in for wild challenges. He's clearly a good player, but like, it's sort of unsustainable sort of trying to murder players on a regular basis, Philippe.
I was looking, Max, at the list of the recent games that Romero has been playing, and I think of the last 10 or 11, there's only one game in which he hasn't been cautioned or sent off. I mean, and I think in some ways he's been lucky in some of those games not to have a second caution, by the way. I mean, was it that brutal, Nicky, beforehand? Or is he even more before he joined Tottenham?
He was always a very aggressive player, and whether it's sort of hit a new level, maybe. I mean, I don't watch Tottenham every week, and I probably saw him more when he was playing in Serie A. I agree with the challenge on Tonali was horrendous in this game, and I wonder if there was a bit with him of sort of frustration of feeling that things are getting away from him. And because it's funny that moment at the beginning that was already talked about when Hernandez barges him off the ball, it actually felt. On the other side of it, you know, Teo's been one of Milan's worst players through January. He really sort of came back from the World Cup in such a funk. And to be honest with you, I almost feel like I've seen this with a few members of that French team that didn't win the World Cup. They've come back to their club sides and it's like they're carrying this hangover with them. And it was only the last game against Torino, I thought, okay, that's a bit more like Teo. He looks a bit like he's back to himself again. And I just... I don't know, maybe I'm over sort of romanticising this moment of the game, but that moment of being able to do it against, you know, someone who you played against the World Cup and just thinking, all right, can you sort of reclaim some power here a little bit? I don't know. I wondered if that maybe felt good for Teo.
Well, speaking of French players who didn't win the World Cup, but did quite well in the World Cup final, Kylian Mbappe, Philippe, sort of changed this game. It was an interesting game, wasn't it? PSG Bayern. It took a while to get going. Bayern sort of dominated. And you sort of think they'll be slightly frustrated that eventually they had to hold on. And you sort of think,
yeah,
Mbappe's fit. If he's fully fit in the next leg, it's still wide open, this game.
I would entirely agree with you. It was a very odd game. First of all, it felt like it was played, if you cut the sound off, you would have thought it was played in the Allianz Arena, because the domination was of Bayern, was the domination of a team playing at home, full of confidence, against a team which had come, you know, dropping back quite considerably, not pressing, even though it's true that with the kind of players that PSG has up front, you won't have much pressing in that area. And it's only when you switch the sound off, you realize, oh, every time Bayern had the ball, there were whistles and boos and everything. But apart from that, PSG were totally inexistent and were totally, in midfield, I mean, they weren't there. They were totally dominated. And I mean, Bayern only scored one goal and on a pretty bad mistake by Donnarumma, it must be said, because if Forster's save was splendid, I mean, the way Donnarumma managed to let that ball squirm, which one?
Squirm.
Under his body.
I'd go squirm, yeah.
Okay, squirm. Yeah. Squirm, not baby not. Squirm under his body was pretty shocking. Even though it was a really good goal by Coman, I mean, the piece of skill, the way he took the ball was excellent. And he was, by the way, absolutely terrific up until Nagelsmann decided to substitute him. And then, as you said, it changed. And it changed not just because of Kylian Mbappe, but also because Vitinha came on. And I think that made a huge difference. But immediately with Kylian Mbappe, who was used the first 5-10 minutes perhaps just to feel himself, making sure that his body was okay. And then suddenly we saw, you know, the burst of space. We saw all the troubles he could bring to that Bayern team, which looked actually quite panicky at times. There was this goal which was chalked off for a very marginal offside after a splendid run by Nuno Mendes on the left-hand side. And, you know, quite a few chances towards the end of the game, despite the fact that Neymar, I was going to say, looked his age, his real age, not the age on his passport, but the age of somebody who spends a lot of time doing things off the pitch, which maybe we should be talking about because it's very funny what's going on at the moment.
Oh, well, tell us now. Tell us now. Why not? What, no time like the present. What's Neymar up to?
Well, because Kylian Mbappe was questioned after the game, and he was asked the question, do you think you can do it in Munich? And he said, provided everyone eats well and sleeps well, I think we can do it. And this came on the heels of a few stories which have been published in the French press about the parties that Neymar is holding in his luxury home in the French banlieue. But that's not the kind of banlieue that you think of, obviously.
Right.
It's more for Londoners and people who know London. It's a bit more Richmond or Barnes than Tower Hamlets. Let's put it that way. It's in Bougival.
God, if you're some sort of middle-aged fan, you know, if you're some family who buy a big old pad in Richmond, and then the person next door is Neymar having parties every day, God, you'd get annoyed, wouldn't you? Banging on the wall. I mean, obviously it's probably a detached house, isn't it? But going around and pressing the buzzer.
Well, the thing is that the neighbors do that, and that's what the story is about. And they keep calling the police, and the mayor of Bougival said, I've had enough of it. Bougival being that suburb. And he said, I've had enough of it, but what can we do? You know, if we're going to fine him €135, which is the statutory fine for this kind of thing, he's just going to give us, you know, it doesn't matter for him. And so they're up in arms and they're wondering, what can we do to stop him having all these parties? And so Mbappe obviously had read that, and that was the first comment he made after the game. But coming back to PSG, in fact, they finished the game on a high when they were actually playing with the kind of team that you were seeing at the beginning of the season, which was really, really stable. You knew exactly what was going on. Donnarumma, okay, was there. Then you had three at the back with, by the way, Sergio Ramos was excellent yesterday.
He was great, wasn't he?
He was superb. And then you had as wing backs, Hakimi and Nuno Mendes. That's a pretty terrifying thing. And then Verratti and Vitinha really working well together. And then the three up front, and you look at that, you think, my goodness, this is a pretty serious team. But because of injuries, because there's this World Cup hangover thing, which is affecting a lot of people, including Neymar, by the way, he hasn't been quite able over the past few weeks to put, you know, to get the kind of performances that we were seeing from the Parisians at the beginning of the season. So it could be that with Mbappe coming back into the team, with Vitinha as well being back in the starting 11, we're going to see the PSG that we saw at the beginning of the season. And that PSG can certainly cause a lot of trouble to Bayern, and it's certainly far, far from over.
Tom says, did Barry know that Daley Blind was at Bayern Munich? From someone who did not know that this himself. Did you know this?
I did, yes.
Yeah, I see, I didn't. And then I was thinking, I didn't when I saw that tweet, and that was after the game. Did he play? Don't tell me you didn't play the whole game or something, and I was there working on the game, not seeing Daley Blind. Who knows? Tonight it's Club Brugge, Benfica, Dortmund, Chelsea. We'll talk about them on tomorrow's pod. Andrew says, if Napoli win the Champions League, will you replace your Subaru with a Fiat Panda? Thank you, Andrew. These questions keep on coming, and that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll look back at Liverpool's win in the Merseyside derby on Monday night. Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. In a couple of weeks, we're going to do a special on disability and football, on all areas of it, accessibility, playing, working in the game, on the good things that clubs are doing and what more needs to be done. As with other specials, we'd love to hear from you on your experiences. They make a huge difference to these pods. The email address is footballweekly@theguardian.com, footballweekly@theguardian.com. Let's talk about the Merseyside derby and do a bit of Sean Dyche and Everton. Marva Creel came on to talk about the last crisis that Everton were in. I mean, they're sort of permanently in a crisis, I guess. But I can't remember if Lampard was still there or if he'd gone, Marva, when we last spoke to you.
I can't remember either. I think he had just gone. I think like the day before he had just gone.
Right. Okay. Well, let's talk about the Merseyside derby first. I mean, I guess, did you come into this game with a kind of weird sense of confidence after what had happened against Arsenal?
I don't think many Everton fans are ever that confident at Anfield, given our track record over the last 20 years. But I do think we probably expected a bit more than what we got, just because the Arsenal performance was so much more than we thought it would be. So we thought maybe there was a chance, but I don't think anyone was particularly expecting a win, let's say.
Yeah, I don't know how you felt about the first goal. I mean, that is fine margins, isn't it? Tarkowski hitting the post and then that sudden breakaway and then somebody accidentally leaning on Jordan Pickford's controller. So he just went for a run at the wrong time.
Yeah, it felt very Everton at Anfield, that whole goal. Maybe the only thing that didn't feel very Everton at Anfield was actually hitting the post, but the reaction afterwards. And I think the manner to concede that goal, I think, set us up. I'm not going to blame it all on that because obviously they did have most possession even up to that. I don't think they were creating loads up until that moment, but definitely, you know, were the better team even until that point. And then I think after that point, it was just all them and it was very comfortable for them.
Philippe, Liverpool sort of did generally dominate, right? They're 9 points off fourth with a game in hand on Newcastle. Are you expecting, could you see from their point of view like a barnstorming run or something that could trouble the top four, given that Newcastle are stuttering a bit, Spurs we've already talked about, perennially hopeless, and then the teams in between them are sort of don't have the experience perhaps?
Yes, you could perhaps see that, provided that there were a number of teams having problems, because, you know, we shouldn't take the others, the smaller ones, out of the equation at all. I wouldn't take Brentford out of it. I wouldn't take Brighton out of it. I would even take Fulham out of it. But what we saw, which looked for me a bit more than an upping of the performance because it's a derby against Everton, was actually quite promising from Liverpool. And what also was very promising is the fact that Diogo Jota is back. Virgil van Dijk will be back very, very soon. So he will soon have an almost complete squad. And then there's Luis Diaz, of course, to come back a little bit later. And the performance, I wouldn't say it was, you know, a cracking, all singing, all dancing performance like by the Liverpool of old. But there were a number of things which I think Jurgen Klopp will have been absolutely delighted with. Because I don't know what Marva thinks about it, because if I compare it to the performance against Arsenal, I don't think that Everton played necessarily that much more badly or that much better in the games, more than that the opposition was not quite on the same level in terms of especially physical engagement, all these 50-50s, which was a little bit unexpected to see this Liverpool midfield, with Fabinho back, by the way, which makes a big difference, being able to actually out-muscle, you know, a midfield in which you've got players like Onana and Doucouré, who were immense against Arsenal, but couldn't repeat that. So from a Liverpool point of view, I thought that was extremely pleasing. But I would imagine that it's more the Champions League I'm thinking of. I'm thinking if they were to play, you know, Real Madrid, I think should be very, very, very worried about that team. This is the competition in which they've got a real chance. And when you see the way that Salah was back to almost his best, Darwin Nunez was superb. There was signs that Gakpo is finding, you know, his feet and his place in the pitch, which was not obvious. You know, as everybody knows, he used to play most on the left-hand side with PSV. Now he's playing more down the middle, playing in a kind of more withdrawn kind of Firmino role. And he seems to be quite good in this. Then there was the young Bajcetic, who was simply magnificent, you know, 18 years of age, and bossing the game. And everywhere you look, you thought, oh, gosh almighty, this is a much, much, much better Liverpool than we've seen almost all season. So, yes, they can certainly put a run of results together. But I would imagine that the Champions League is probably the competition in which people should be wary of them.
Marva, how have you felt about Sean Dyche coming in and kind of all the stereotype, you know, all the classic things you wanted, like from Sean Dyche arriving and bleep tests? Someone told me they were called beep tests, not bleep tests, but I very much believe it's there's an L in the bleep, and you know, no snoods, etc., etc.
I mean, I think all of that stuff is what it is. I think a lot of it is often quite hyped up in terms of what it actually leads to. You have a lot of managers who come in and complain about fitness, you know, when they start. But I think in terms of that Arsenal game, while I hope it's not an exception to the rule, did show everything that you can do under a Daesh team. It felt great, not only obviously because we needed that win, and not only was it against Arsenal, but it had a kind of feel of a peak Moyes team almost, where, you know, the things that you're doing for Everton are you're fighting constantly. It's not always going to be the prettiest football, but it's a hard place to go. And that's what we need to make Goodison into again. I think the thing with last time I was on here, you know, I was talking about the kind of lack of planning from Everton, and I don't think anything quite shows a lack of planning just like getting Daesh in and not having the players to field a 4-4-2 formation. It's actually quite unbelievable. And when I saw the Arsenal game, I think it was reassuring because he played sort of 4-5-1, and where we do have a bit of depth is our centre midfielders, and where we have the most talent, I would say, is our centre midfielders. But then with a 4-5-1, you need your one, and without Calvert-Lewin against Arsenal, against Liverpool, you show the difference between against, you know, Liverpool and Arsenal, because in those moments where we did get the ball and put it forward against Arsenal, it allowed us to be on the front foot a bit more, because Calvert-Lewin is actually, his hold-up play is actually pretty good, and his layoff play actually is very good as well. And you saw, you know, Ellis Sims, I don't want to sort of berate him too much, because obviously that's a ridiculous game to come into for your first game in so long. But there were a few moments, even in the first kind of 15 minutes, where the ball had come to him and he lost it or couldn't quite get it. And it makes a massive difference, because if you just have those few little moments, it changes the feel of the game. And we didn't have that against Liverpool. It meant that there was nothing for our three central midfielders to play into. There was nothing for them to do once they got the ball. And then it just became quite sloppy. I think everyone's sort of heads went down a bit. But having said that, if Tarkowski had scored at that moment at the back post, then maybe we've got a different game. Yeah, I think we're going to have to really, really find, I don't even want to say plan B, because we've tried so many plans, but without Calvert-Lewin, what do we do? And how have we not gotten a replacement for him? We don't even have wingers really for Daesh. We've got McNeil, we've got Gray, who he's not the kind of winger that Daesh will want to play on the wing. I think if he plays him, it's going to be more as the one up front. And we're playing Iwobi on the wing, where his best position so far has been in centre mid. So it just shows you, again, our lack of planning for a 4-4-2 situation.
Yeah, Ellis Sims was on loan at Sunderland for the first half of the season and did well, scored a few goals, but I don't think he's ready for the step up. And a friend of mine who watches Sunderland week in, week out said at the moment, he's definitely not ready for the step up. So could we have him back, please?
You could just imagine, you know, Connor Cody yelling, "It's got to stick. It's got to stick." I've done that Sunday league clogger up front in your old role. And you just, you know, it's got to stick, you know, and it didn't. And that did make a difference. Finally, Marv, I just wonder, do Everton fans need a sort of mindset change? You know, there is a snobbery from a club of a certain size that they don't want someone like Sean Dyche. And so, you know, are you sort of going, it's great now, we'll survive, and then we'll go and find someone who plays nice football? Or do you think the fans need to kind of change their mindset and go, look, he was good at Burnley, we should have more better players, more money, like he could actually do something in the long term?
Yeah, I don't think it's a case of the type of football we play. I think it's the slight snobbery. I haven't said that. You said that. The slight snobbery has come from maybe it's more our position in the league table. I think it's for Everton fans, it's never particularly about beautiful football. I think if we're getting eighth place and playing, you know, tough defensive football, the Goodison crowd won't care. There's a lot of shouts for forward passing at Goodison. But other than that, as long as it's going forward in some direction, whether it's hoofed or, you know, beautifully passed on the ground, I don't think the Goodison crowd care. So I don't think that that's the thing that would hold back Daesh at all. The thing right now that's looking to hold him back is that we haven't brought in the resources for him, really. I know he's done kind of a better job with less resources previously, but this relegation battle currently is a very tough one. There's no... no offence to them, but there's no Norwich this year, you know. There's no kind of real set one or two teams that are going down. It's not four teams fighting against one relegation place. It's kind of like seven, eight teams fighting against three relegation places, and there's no real standout. We've all got our kind of our pros and our cons, so it's a really, really tough battle for him, especially without a striker that he can rely on in terms of fitness.
Just to be clear, I wasn't accusing Everton fans of snobbery. The supporters of all big clubs. It's every single big club. All snobs. Marva, thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate your time.
Cheers. Thank you.
Marva Creel there, broadcaster, Everton fan. While we're on Liverpool, Chris says, do you think the findings after the Paris debacle will actually change anything, given UEFA and the French have requested heavy redaction in the report, indicating they're still trying to protect themselves? So UEFA commissioned an independent report into the scenes before and after the game between Liverpool and Real Madrid in the Champions League final, which saw supporters being tear gassed by police and being attacked by locals. The report found that UEFA bears primary responsibility for the events that almost led to disaster. Following the release of the report, Liverpool put out a statement which said last night UEFA published the report into the failings that we saw firsthand in Paris. It's within this context that we call on UEFA and others at the top of the football regulation pyramid to come together and take positive and transparent action to ensure there are no more near misses. We implore UEFA to fully enact the recommendations as outlined by the panel, no matter how difficult, to ensure supporter safety is the number one priority at the heart of every UEFA football fixture. And like Barry's, I remember we were on the radio together the day after and hearing from Liverpool fans talking about like how close that was to a disaster. And this report basically said, you know, if it wasn't for the behaviour of the Liverpool fans, this could have been spectacularly worse.
Yeah, I mean, this report and investigation, which took 6 months, it hasn't told us anything we didn't already know, but obviously it has to be thorough and that's why it took 6 months. But at the time of Hillsborough, there were no camera phones, there was no rolling Sky News, you know, reporters outside grounds weren't a thing before games. And so we kind of took the word of what we heard, you know, from the police or the government. And this time in Paris, UEFA, the police, and some government ministers squarely tried to lay the blame on Liverpool fans. But we all knew they were lying because we'd seen the phone videos, we'd heard from the reporters outside the ground, we'd got first-hand accounts from Liverpool fans who were able to back up their claims with video footage or other people's video footage. So we haven't really learned anything new. And it's important to remember that this investigation was commissioned by UEFA. They'd already tried to blame Liverpool fans, so the investigation couldn't blame them again because we know the claims were bogus or the accusations and smears were bogus. So the big finger of blame has been pointed at UEFA largely, with the police and various government officials getting a shooing as well. But the language in it is so damning. Like, it's incredibly damning. Whether it will change anything, probably not. Seferin is still going to get re-elected as president unopposed. He should resign, I think, but obviously he won't. But it may open the eyes of people at UEFA that this culture of blame shifting that's so prevalent in sporting bodies, governments, whatever, the police, it's not going to really work anymore because everyone has a camera in their pocket. Everyone can provide contrasting footage, which torpedoes these claims from UEFA, the government, the police out of the water.
Yeah, I think we have to insist on the language they used in the report. I've never seen this in a report issued by a sports organization. I will just quote one paragraph from the executive summary, Max. It has been a feature of our investigations that several key stakeholders have not accepted responsibility for their own failures, but have been quick to attribute blame to others. Some have continued to make allegations, in particular against supporters, based upon facts for which there is no evidence. And the whole of the report, which is 200 pages long, you know, is that kind of language, which is totally unique. And so I think we should also, by the way, even if huge reservations, almost commend UEFA for doing this. And I know that I'm probably going to shock a few people by saying that, but I can't remember a sports body deciding to put together a commission panel. When you read the names, you thought, this is pretty serious. And then having this being thrown in their faces, which they must have been expecting. Now, you could be thinking that it is quite Machiavellian, because in a way that's a means for UEFA to say, we're putting our hands up, you know, at least we're doing what we should be doing, and we're going to take responsibility for it, and we're going to draw the consequences from that. So you might think it was a very clever thing to do, especially because of the weight of evidence against the assertions which were casted at supporters in particular. Which consequences it will have, I don't know. My main concern is not for UEFA, because I do think they're going to tighten a lot of things there, but it's more for the French authorities, because the way football is policed in France is absolutely appalling. As any supporter will tell you, especially away supporters, it's absolutely appalling, when they're allowed to travel, that is. And the fact that the police is so heavy-handed, the fact that the authorities immediately put the blame when there is any incident on the supporters and never look at themselves, I don't think that's going to change. And we've got two major events coming to Paris, which are going to use the Stade de France. And they are, you know, the Rugby World Cup and the Olympic Games. And we can't have the same failures, obviously, happening in that. Which is another thing, which it really actually made me stop in my tracks when I was reading the report. And when they say all the stakeholders interviewed by the panel have agreed that this situation was a near miss, a term used when an event almost turns into a mass fatality catastrophe. And I think with the passage of time, we've quite forgotten how serious this was. So this is, you know, this really, and there have been quite a few, you know, awful things happening at football games in the past year or so, and be it in Africa or in Asia, where basically everything, you know, there were inquiries and panels put in place. It's not going to lead anywhere. At least in this case, let's hope it does lead us somewhere and that UEFA does what it has to do. But again, for the French authorities, I don't think there's going to be the same level of responsibility. I fear that.
Okay, that'll do for part two. Part three will begin by looking ahead to Arsenal versus Manchester City. Hi, Pod fans. Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Premier League tonight, then first versus second. Man City go to Arsenal with a chance to jump above them. Nicky and Philippe, both Arsenal fans. Nicky, how are you feeling about this game?
Oh, horrible. Of course feeling horrible. We've dropped 5 points in two games. Of course feel horrible about it. Now they can go top of the league, even if it's, you know, we'll still have the game in hand. Of course, as a fan, it feels very, very anxious. And I don't know, I maybe Philippe will contradict me on this, but I think a lot of Arsenal fans realistically have gone through a lot of this season with at least some amount of inferiority complex, right? Like even when we were sort of telling ourselves, God, this is really good football, and it has been really good football at times. There's been a lot of, we're not really supposed to be ahead of Man City though, are we? I mean, we aren't there. And yeah, there've been times when you start to think, oh, maybe we are, maybe we really could have been. And indeed, I know some people are already looking at this game and thinking, God, if we just played this in September when everyone was fit, when we were flying, when Jesus was there, would we have been able to beat them? And now we're playing them at the point where we're wobbling. And, you know, that's kind of a silly conversation actually, because maybe not playing them there, not getting a setback then, which we might have had, is what allowed the team to build as much confidence as it had and go on the run it has. So you can argue that in circles. But look, I think there's lots of reasons that you can equally come to and say Arsenal can be competitive in this game. I mean, for starters, you're not going to see Man City park the bus. They're going to come and play an open game. And actually, that's something that Arsenal haven't seen for a few matches. And it's not like you suddenly don't have Saka and Odegaard and all of that attacking talent. It's still there. So I think it's got the potential to be a brilliant game. But as a fan, of course, I think the official term is bricking it.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And Philippe, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, Man City, it's us against the world, all these Premier League charges. Mm. Arsenal, it's us against the world, because not only are you playing Man City, you're playing the PGMOL as well. So like both.
And the media.
And the media, yeah. So like both of you like have this sort of burning rage inside you for the head of this game.
I wouldn't quite equate the situation that Manchester City finds themselves in regarding the Premier League investigation with somebody forgetting to draw a line on a screen, because I think he was given 14 or 15 seconds because to actually do that, because he'd been spending so much time on the previous incident, which was not an incident, that he basically said, well, okay, no, that's fine. I wouldn't quite say that. And I also think that the kind of reaction we had to the shenanigans, the VAR shenanigans at the weekend, come from a minority of supporters. That's not really, I think people are more taking it's like a Gallic shrug. You know, these things happen. The problem is more with VAR in general. It's not with Arsenal. There is no plot against Arsenal, blah, blah, blah. No, this is ridiculous.
Jill, it's interesting you say that because we had quite a lot of reaction. I mean, not huge, but enough to sort of notice it after Monday's pod, where me, Barney, Barry and Noreen Chowdhury sort of found it all quite funny, the amount of refereeing mistakes. So just a catalogue, and they were just like so ridiculous that we could only find it amusing. But like an example of a message from Matt saying, "Hi, Max, it's a bit odd that you find the huge refereeing mistakes something to laugh at. The so-called biggest league in the world should have the best people controlling the game. Just as bigger organisations have better auditors, the Premier League should have better officials. Drawing incorrect or no lines is unforgivable. There is no accountability, which is why fans are up in arms. These mistakes can potentially cost millions of pounds at the end of the season, could be the difference between relegation and remaining in the league. There will always be errors on things like tight calls, difficult angles. That's absolutely understandable and to be expected. But to not draw the lines, all the wrong lines, and everyone in Stockley Park missed the fact, that just isn't good enough. We were on Monday accused of being out of touch with the fans, with football fans in general, being elitist, smug, of not letting Noz speak, of not really realising that accountability and refereeing is important for a fully functioning society. I'm not trying to laugh at this because...
Hold on. We are football fans. I'm a football fan. You're a football fan.
Yeah.
Noz is a football fan and Barney is a football fan. So we're not out of touch. We are fans. And I would like to know where all these great referees are supposed to come from. You know, the reason there are referees make mistakes is because there aren't enough referees. And the reason there aren't enough referees is because referees at grassroots level get abused by paranoid fans for making errors and just give up because it's not worth the hassle. They get abused from players, they get abused from managers, and they get abused from fans. This is all trickles down from the top. So, you know, by all means, get in an army of infallible referees who never make mistakes. But I'm very curious to know where they're going to come from.
I think what's quite interesting is whether, you know, if you are paid to watch football and you are, you know, you have that privilege, you experience it in a different way to people who pay a lot of money and travel a long way and then get infuriated by these decisions. And I suspect those fans get annoyed when you just kind of shrug it off going, oh, well, people make mistakes. I mean, I'm not saying you, because I did as well, but people make mistakes. Because you're like, I've invested so much time and money in this thing, and these people are just kind of laughing about it. I mean, I've got to be honest, that was my reaction. I can't change that.
Well, I've invested a lot of time and money in following GAA teams in Ireland, and refereeing mistakes never bothered me then, but some of my friends would be absolutely outraged by them. And I mean, referees who make mistakes in GAA matches have been known to end up trussed up in the boots of cars or being beaten up or physically assaulted on the pitch. So, you know, some people take it more serious than others. They don't bother me. You know, these things happen. And that's my opinion, and it's not going to change.
Nikki?
I just think it can be both, can't it? Like, as a fan, when it's an important situation, which it was obviously for Arsenal, like, it's going to eat at you. And if Arsenal don't win the league, you're not going to sort of get rid of that feeling of, oh, what if they hadn't got that wrong? And I think you can sort of acknowledge that and also say exactly what Baz has just said. It's not a job you're ever going to achieve perfection in. You're just not. Like, it doesn't matter what punishments you give referees, doesn't matter what sort of incentives you create. There's always going to be mistakes. Every season, no matter what the technology is, we've seen that as well, with and without technology. So on some level, you do just kind of have to come to terms. It doesn't mean you can't complain about it, though. Complain about it all you like.
And going back to the original correspondent, could we just put this one to bed for once and for all? Because I hear it all the time. No team has ever been relegated because of a bad refereeing decision. Teams are relegated because they're shit. And they've been shit over an extended period of time. And that is why teams are relegated. There's 20 teams in the Premier League. You only have to be better than three of them. So, you know, don't give me that one. Oh, livelihoods are on the line. No, they're not.
Though teams have been deprived of titles because of refereeing mistakes. That has happened a number of times. But the thing, it is compounded by the fact that for some weird reason, perhaps because of the way VAR has been sold to us and technology has been sold to us, is that it one of the aims is to almost eliminate a human error. And therefore, we've come to have completely unrealistic expectations because it's still human beings making the decisions. But because the expectations are so high, the reactions are exaggerated. And so it feeds itself. One thing which would certainly make I think life a little bit easier for everybody would be if in the Premier League and actually in the English Football League, we were to adopt the policy that they've got in MLS, by which at the end of each game, the people who are reporting on the game get together, write three questions, which are then put by one journalist to the referees and then shared amongst the reporters, which means that if there is an incident in a game that people don't quite understand, why did you decide this, Mr. Referee? Why did you whistle or not whistle? Well, they do have an answer, and it's led to a pacification of the debate around refereeing. And I think it's something that Peter Mould should be looking at and the Premier League should be looking at, and which would be very easy to implement. And to be honest, I think referees themselves would actually welcome this opportunity to explain themselves. At the moment, they can't, and they're just hung out to dry.
With offside specifically, like the one that Arsenal were aggrieved about at the weekend, there is semi-automatic offside technology now being used in Serie A, for instance, and that will come. Like, it's like goal line technology. That's something that is actually absolutely measurable. So eventually, I believe that we will get to the point when that's absolute. Although I also saw this morning, and I just could not stop laughing about it. Anyone else saw it? There was a thing shared on Twitter, which was someone who got into an argument with Bing's new artificial intelligence, because the artificial intelligence was adamant that it was 2022 and was being so aggressive about it. And this whole conversation goes with this sort of passive aggressive tone from this AI that gets more and more hostile into it, basically shuts down the conversation and says, I can't talk to you anymore because you're acting in bad faith towards me.
Oh, that'd be great. When the robots screw it all up, it'll be brilliant. You mentioned, Baz, about grassroots levels refereeing. BBC Sport released an article discussing the abuse referees get at grassroots level. I made a mini documentary with Chris Sutton exploring it. More than 900 referees in England responded to a Five Live questionnaire. 293 said they'd been physically abused by spectators, players, coaches or managers. Some described being punched, headbutted and spat at. A trial of referees wearing body cameras in adults grassroots football is planned to start this year, which is a good idea and simultaneously incredibly depressing that, you know, that has to happen. Moving on, Rhys, how much do you admire Jesse Marsh's decision to take on the Southampton job? After all, he could have settled down on a ranch in Wisconsin, married a nice American girl, raised some cattle, and had a nice life. Gary, what do you make of this move to Southampton?
It's quite interesting because Nathan Jones replaced a manager I still haven't decided is whether he's any good or not. I still don't know if Nathan Jones is any good or not. And now Nathan Jones is being replaced by a manager whose credentials I'm still very much up in the air about. He might do okay there. I guess Southampton fans would be fairly underwhelmed because it seems like a like-for-like replacement. A guy who talks a good game but doesn't necessarily always deliver one accentuates positives I tend not to be able to see in the wake of getting a bad result, and also comes out with a lot of shit.
Yeah, at midnight last night, said he was still the head coach of Leeds on his LinkedIn. So he's got to update that. So a fascinating appointment, isn't it? And interesting to see how he goes. While we're on Southampton, they play Grimsby in the FA Cup, and Grimsby Town released a statement saying the club have today received confirmation from Southampton that Harry Haddocks will not be permitted at St Mary's for our Emirates FA Cup fifth round. We made initial requests to the Premier League club last week for our supporters to be able to bring the iconic inflatable to our fifth round tie on the 1st of March. This afternoon, our host officially declined the request. Southampton have made similar refusals to other clubs throughout this campaign. How many similar refusals have they? How many clubs have said, can I take an inflatable fish to your football match? And why are you refusing it? It is not a decision just aimed at Mariners supporters. Any supporters who take Harry Haddocks into the stadium will have them confiscated. What will then Southampton then do with them? We share our supporters' inevitable frustration at this decision. We know you'll support us brilliantly in our FA Cup fifth round tie, the first one since 1996. You do think with all things in the world, they should be allowed to take an inflatable fish into St Mary's, but perhaps there's a sensible reason for it. That could be Jesse Marsh's first move to allow the inflatable Haddocks. Richard Jolly stat saying in 1995, Neil Warnock was the manager of Huddersfield and Gigi Buffon played for Parma. In 2023, Neil Warnock is the manager of Huddersfield and Gigi Buffon is playing for Parma. So how good is that? Welcome back, Neil Warnock, 74, and managing Huddersfield. Jim says, I just want to say how ecstatic I am that Jakub Jankto has sought to be his authentic self. He obviously feels it's best for him, and if it helps just one other person feel a little less alone for being a gay man who's into football, it's utterly worthwhile. Yeah, the Czech Republic and Sparta Prague midfielder, the highest profile current male player to publicly come out after Josh Cavallo of Adelaide United, Jack Daniels of Blackpool. He said, like everyone else, I want to live my life with freedom, without fear, without violence, without prejudice, but with love. Nicky, you tweeted about that particular quote, didn't you?
Yeah, I think that really says it in such a powerful way. I mean, we're living in like this horrible, gruesome, genuinely costing lives out there for people, culture war at the moment, not just in England. I think all over the world, this seems to be a moment that's happening in which people sort of constantly portray LGBTQ plus people as some sort of conspiracy in a collective sense, when actually most of us are just people getting on with our lives and worrying about the same boring rubbish that you lot are, who aren't LGBTQ, you lot is a very bad way to phrase it, but you know what I mean. The problem is that it's stupid, but if you're sort of trying to live that normal life, but also like there's a significant part of who you are that you cannot acknowledge all of the time, that eats away at you. That takes away part of your ability to live freely and to just get on with everything else, because that's something that's just constantly on your shoulders. And I was thinking about this actually because, you know, Jankto came to Italy, to Serie A. He played a good chunk of his career in Serie A, very well, by the way. I thought he was a very good player at Sampdoria. I was just checking earlier because he came in 2014. And it's only 5 years before that that Marcello Lippi, then the Italy manager, so the manager of Italy at that time, was asked about gay players in football. He said he'd never come across one. And he said if there was a gay footballer, he would support them, but he would tell them, don't talk about it in public. He's like, go live your life. Just don't talk about it in public. And that's been the message so sort of often and so commonly. And like, would you honestly expect a straight player to never mention their partner? Like, is that a standard that we hold straight players to? Just play football, never mention your partner. I get that some people go, well, yeah, actually, I don't really want to hear about what they're doing in the bedroom. And I understand that. But actually, take a step back, because Jakub Jankto isn't talking about what he's doing in the bedroom. He just wants to be able to acknowledge that if he has a boyfriend or if he's got a partner or whatever else, he can talk about that as something that is part of his life, because that's all it is. And that, I think, is just a really sort of fundamental thing that LGBTQ plus people are often not allowed. And again, the Italy manager in 2009, I know it's longer ago than I think it is 2009, but it's still not that long ago, feeling able to say that, like, just don't do it in public. I mean, come on, like, it's
and also sort of saying it in a way that is kind of trying to be supportive, like trying to be kind of helpful.
Absolutely, you know? He thinks he's being supportive. He thinks that's the right thing to say, to be supportive. And yeah, anyway, I'm delighted for Jakob. I think that the way he said that was really, really powerful. And I hope that now he can talk about it exactly as if there is as much as he wants to. And that's just the load off that he wanted.
Yes. It's just one thing I would like to add to this, and which has to do with the double standards of FIFA, as per usual. Because when Jakub Jankto published his video, FIFA said, you know, that's wonderful, we support him fully. And what did they do 24 hours later? They gave the Club World Cup to Saudi Arabia, where homosexuality and actually homosexuals and also transgender people are facing very severe repression. And I mean very severe repression. And within 24 hours, we saw both sides of FIFA, basically.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, the hypocrisy is... Adam Crafton, you know, tweeted it brilliantly when he just said, you know... Adam, who, you know, works for The Athletic, is openly gay and did some brilliant reporting out in Qatar and spoke to him about that on the radio. Saying, you know, today I feel gay. You know, today we feel gay, like ripping off Infantino's speech, because, yeah, there's words and there's actions and they have to combine if you want to be taken seriously in this or in any space, don't you? Moving subject quite dramatically, Ben says, was this the best ever comeback? And his second point is, was there any other way they could have worded it? So the comeback is Wingate and Finchley at home to Bowers and Pitsey in the Isthmian League. Bowers and Pitsey were 3-0 up in the 81st minute, and Wingate and Finchley scored in the 82nd, 86th, 94th and 98th minute. And Bowers and Pitsey's Twitter said, full time, Bowers throw away a 3-0 lead to lose 4-3 as Wingate score four times in the last 8 minutes. No other way to put it than we fucked it. Admirable honesty. I'd love to hear what the manager said after the game. Andrew says, have you ever seen a better goal at Cambridge than the one Elliot Bond scored tonight? It was a good goal, and Cheltenham beat Cambridge and Lee. I've always wanted to be back in League Two, is all I can say. Has there ever been a better special guest than when Stars brought Philippe out on Sunday night? Philippe, tell us about it.
Well, my friends from Stars, whom I've known for a good many years, and different to me, I've had two platinum records, are touring Europe at the moment. And they just rang me and said, you know, Louis, because that's my name, would you like to join us for a song? So I joined them for a lovely song at the beautiful Lafayette venue, absolutely magnificent venue. And I got a big round of applause. And it was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful to be with my friends on stage.
Did you get a bigger applause for that or when you joined me for In Your Back Garden at Glasgow?
I think it's a close one saying, but perhaps I think Back Garden will remain
musically,
perhaps my greatest.
Was musically, yeah.
Musically, at least, yes, absolutely. Marvelous. But it was wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
Oh, I'm delighted. I'm sad I wasn't there. Anyway, that'll do for today's podcast. Thank you, Philippe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
Thanks.
Thanks, Nikki.
Thanks.
Arsenal City tonight, so we'll be back tomorrow talking about that one. Football Weekly was produced by Silas Gray. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.